He says Greg Saunders was entering the courthouse when an old lawyer, one of Ada's veterans, asked him, "Who's the smart son of a bitch that left Cecil Smith on the jury?" Greg said, "Well, I guess that would be me. Who's Cecil Smith?" "Used to be the chief of police here in Ada, that's all." Saunders was stunned. He marched into Judge Jones's office and demanded a mistrial on the grounds that the juror had not been forthcoming during the selection process and that the juror was obviously biased toward the police and prosecution. The motion was overruled. Dr. Fred Jordan testified about his autopsy, and the jury heard the gruesome details. Photos of the body were introduced and passed through the jury box, provoking the shock and outrage inherent in any murder trial. Several of the jurors glared in disgust at Fritz. With the solid, unimpeachable testimony of Dr. Jordan still hanging in the air, the prosecution decided to slip in a few of its off-the-wall witnesses. A man named Gary Allen was sworn in and took the stand. Allen's involvement was quite tenuous. He told the jury that he lived near Dennis Fritz, and that one night in early December 1982, at about 3:30 a.m., he heard two men outside his apartment making noise. He wasn't sure of the exact date, but for some reason was certain that it was before December 10th. The two men, neither of whom he saw clearly enough to identify, were in the yard laughing, cursing, and squirting each other with a garden hose. The temperature was cold, and the men had their shirts off. He had known Dennis Fritz for some time and thought he recognized his voice, but he wasn't sure. He listened to the noise for about 10 minutes, then went back to bed. When Allen was excused as a witness, there were a few puzzled looks in the courtroom. What exactly was the purpose of his testimony? Things would get even more confusing with the next witness, Tony Vick. Vick lived in the small apartment under Gary Allen, and he knew Dennis Fritz. He also knew Ron Williamson. He testified that he'd seen Ron on the porch at Dennis's place, and that he knew for a fact that the two had taken a trip together to Texas in the summer of 1982. Now, what more could the jury ask for? The damning evidence continued to pile up with Donna Walker, a convenience store clerk who identified Dennis in court and said that she had once known him pretty well. Way back in 1982, Dennis was a frequent customer at her store, a regular coffee drinker who liked to chat her up early in the mornings. Ron was a customer too, and she knew for a fact that he and Dennis were pals. Then, suddenly, after the murder, the two stopped drinking coffee at her store. They vanished, as far as she was concerned. Then, after staying away for a few weeks, they reappeared as if nothing had happened. But they had changed. How? Their character, their dress. They always dressed nice and were clean-shaven before, and they just went completely down. Filthy clothing, unshaven, hair was a mess. Their character had changed. They seemed kind of nervous and paranoid, I guess. When pressed by Greg Saunders, Walker couldn't explain why she waited 5 years before sharing this crucial evidence with the police. She did admit that the cops approached her the previous August, after Dennis and Ron were arrested. The parade continued with Letha Caldwell, a divorcee who had attended junior high school with Ron at Bing. She told the jury that Dennis Fritz and Ron Williamson were frequent visitors to her home late at night, at irregular hours, and that they were always drinking. At some point, she became frightened of them and asked them to stay away. When they refused, she bought a gun and showed it to them, at which time they decided she was serious. Her testimony had nothing to do with the murder of Debbie Carter, and in many courtrooms would have been objected to as totally irrelevant to the issues. The objection finally came when OSBI agent Rusty Featherstone testified. Peterson, in a clumsy attempt to prove that Ron and Dennis were carousing in Norman 4 months before the murder, put Featherstone on the stand. Featherstone had given Dennis 2 polygraph exams in 1983, but for many excellent reasons, the results were inadmissible. During the interviews, Dennis had recounted a night in Norman that involved bars and drinking. When Peterson attempted to elicit this story from Featherstone, Greg Saunders objected loudly. Judge Jones sustained it on the grounds of being irrelevant. During the skirmish, Peterson, at a bench conference, said, "He, Featherstone, places both Ron Williamson and Dennis Fritz as associating with each other in August of 1982. "Tell me the relevance of that statement," Judge Jones demanded. Peterson could not, and Featherstone quickly left the courtroom. It was another appearance by another witness who knew nothing about the murder of Debbie Carter. The next witness was just as unproductive, though his testimony was somewhat interesting. William Martin was the principal of the junior high in Noble, where Dennis taught in 1982. He testified that on the morning of December 8th, a Wednesday, Dennis called in sick, and a substitute teacher taught his classes. According to the attendance records Martin brought to court, Dennis missed a total of 7 days during the 9-month school year. After 12 witnesses, the state had not laid a glove on Dennis Fritz. The prosecution had proven beyond any doubt whatsoever that he drank alcohol, ran with unsavory people, Ron Williamson, shared an apartment with his mother and daughter in the same neighborhood as Debbie Carter's apartment, and missed school the day after the murder. Peterson's style was methodical. He believed it was necessary to slowly build a case, block by block, witness by witness, nothing fancy or slick. Gradually pile on the evidence and remove all doubt from the minds of the jurors. But Fritz was quite a challenge because there was no hard evidence. Snitches were needed. The first one to testify was James Harjo, brought in, like Gore, from prison. Dull and dim-witted, Harjo had not only burglarized the same house twice, but used the identical means of entry, same bedroom, same window. When he was caught, he was interrogated by the police. Using a pen and sheet of paper, articles foreign to Harjo, the cops had walked the boy through his story with diagrams and solved the crime. Evidently, this had impressed Harjo greatly. When he was in jail with Dennis, he, at the urging of the police, decided to crack the Carter murder by doodling on a sheet of paper. He explained this shrewd strategy to the jury. In the crowded bullpen of the jail, he had quizzed Dennis about the murder. At some point, when his X's and O's reached their climax, he said to Dennis, "Well, it looks like you're guilty." Dennis, overcome by the weight of Harjo's deft logic, withered under the burden and tearfully said, "We didn't mean to hurt her." When Harjo first spun this yarn during the preliminary hearing, Dennis erupted and yelled, "You are lying! You are lying!" But with a jury watching closely, he had to suffer through it again without showing any emotion. While it was difficult, he was encouraged to see several of the jurors suppressing a chuckle at Harjo's silly story. On cross-examination, Greg Saunders established that Dennis and Harjo were housed in one of the jail's two bullpens, small, open areas accessible to 4 cells with 2 bunks each. Each bullpen was designed for 8 men, but was often more crowded than that. Even in the bullpen, the men were practically breathing on each other. Surprisingly, in the Pontotoc County Jail, no one else heard Dennis's dramatic confession. Harjo testified that he enjoyed telling lies to Ron about Dennis, and vice versa. Greg Saunders asked him, "Why were you lying on Dennis and Ron Williamson? Why were you going back and forth and telling them lies about each other?" "Just to watch and see what they say. They'll cut each other's throats if you watch them." "And you were lying to Ron about Dennis, or lying to Dennis about Ron, is that right? Kind of to get them at each other's throats?" "Yeah, just see what they'd say." Harjo later admitted he did not understand the meaning of the word perjury. The next informant was Mike Tenney, the jailer trainee who'd been used by the police to gather some dirt on Dennis. With little experience or training in law enforcement, Tenney began his career at the jail, and his first assignment had been Dennis Fritz. Eager to impress those who might hire him permanently, he spent a lot of time outside Dennis's cell, chatting about everything, but especially about the Carter murder. He had plenty of advice. In his learned opinion, Dennis's situation looked grave, so the best thing to do would be to cut a deal, negotiate a plea bargain, save his own skin, and testify against Ron Williamson. Peterson would be fair. Dennis had played along, careful to say nothing because anything might be repeated in court. Being a rookie, Tenney had not testified much and had not fully rehearsed his lines. He began by trying to recall a story about Dennis and Ron hopping bars in Oklahoma City, a story not even remotely connected to the Carter murder. Saunders objected. Judge Jones sustained. Then Tenney stepped into hot water when he testified that he and Dennis discussed the issue of a plea bargain. Twice he mentioned a plea bargain, a highly prejudicial issue, because it strongly implied that Dennis had contemplated pleading guilty. Greg Saunders objected loudly and moved for a mistrial. Judge Jones overruled. Tenney finally managed to testify without the lawyers jumping to their feet. He explained to the jury that he had spoken often with Dennis, and after every conversation, he had hustled back to the front desk at the jail and written down everything that was said. According to his handler, Gary Rogers, this was the way things were done. Good police work. And during one of their little chats, Dennis allegedly said, "Let's say it might have happened this way. Maybe Ron went to the door and broke into Carter's apartment, and then let's say he went ahead and got a little. Ron got a little bit carried away and was going to teach her a lesson. She died. Let's say it happened this way. But I didn't see Ron kill her, so how can I tell the DA something I really didn't see?" After Tenney, the trial was recessed for the day, and Dennis was taken back to the jail. He carefully removed his new suit and put it on a hanger. A guard took it up front. He stretched out on his bunk, closed his eyes, and wondered how the nightmare would end. He knew the witnesses were lying, but did the jury? The next morning, Bill Peterson called to the stand Cindy McIntosh, who admitted being in jail on bad check charges when she met both Dennis Fritz and Ron Williamson. She testified that she overheard the two talking, with Ron asking Dennis about the crime scene photos of Debbie Carter. "Was she on the bed or on the floor?" Ron asked Dennis. "On the floor," Dennis said. McIntosh admitted that she was not convicted on the check charges. "I paid off the checks and they let me out," she said. With the snitches out of the way, Peterson returned to more credible proof. Slightly more credible. He called to the stand four consecutive witnesses who worked for the state crime lab. Their impact on the jury was profound, as it always is. They were educated, trained, certified, experienced, and they worked for the state of Oklahoma. They were experts, and they were there to testify against the defendant to help prove his guilt. The first was the fingerprint expert, Jerry Peters. He explained to the jury that he examined 21 prints lifted from Debbie's apartment and car, 19 of which were Debbie's. One matched Detective Dennis Smith, one matched Mike Carpenter, and not a single fingerprint belonged to either Dennis Fritz or Ron Williamson. Odd that the fingerprint expert would testify that none of the fingerprints were left behind by the accused. Larry Mullins described how he reprinted Debbie's palms the previous May when her body was exhumed. He gave the new prints to Jerry Peters, who suddenly saw things he hadn't seen 4.5 years earlier. The prosecution's theory, the same one to be used against Ron Williamson, was that during the prolonged and violent assault Debbie was wounded, her blood somehow ended up on her left palm, and this palm touched a tiny portion of sheetrock just above the floor of her bedroom. Since the palm print did not belong to Ron or Dennis, and it certainly could not belong to the real killer, it had to be Debbie's. Mary Long was a criminalist who worked primarily with body fluids. She explained to the jury that about 20% of all people do not show their blood type in body fluids, such as saliva, semen, and sweat. This segment is known in the trade as non-secretors. Based on her examination of the blood and saliva samples from Ron and Dennis, she was certain that they were non-secretors. The person who left the semen at the crime scene was probably a non-secretor, too, though Long was not certain because the evidence was insufficient. Thus, 80% of the population was eliminated from suspicion, or around 80%, give or take a few points. Nonetheless, Fritz and Williamson now bore the ominous tag of non-secretors. Long's math was blown away on cross-examination when Greg Saunders forced her to admit that most of the blood and saliva samples she analyzed in the Carter case came from non-secretors. Of the 20 samples she examined, 12 were from non-secretors, including Fritz and Williamson. 60% of those in her pool of suspects were non-secretors, as opposed to the national average of only 20%. It didn't matter. Her testimony excluded many and helped raise the suspicion hanging over the head of Dennis Fritz. The state's last witness was by far its most effective. Peterson saved his knockout punch for the last round, and when Melvin Hett finished testifying, the jury was convinced. Hett was the OSBI hair man, a veteran testifier who'd helped send many people to prison. Forensic examination of human hair got off to a rocky start as far back as 1882. In a Wisconsin case that year, an expert for the state compared a known hair sample with one found at the crime scene and testified that the two came from the same source. The source was convicted, but on appeal, the Wisconsin Supreme Court reversed and said strongly, "Such evidence is of the most dangerous character." Thousands of innocent defendants could have been spared if that decision had been heeded. Instead, police, investigators, crime labs, and prosecutors plowed ahead with the analysis of hair, which was often the only real clue left at a crime scene. Hair analysis became so common and so controversial that it was studied many times throughout the 20th century. Many of the studies indicated a high rate of error. And in response to the controversy, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration sponsored a crime lab proficiency program in 1978. 240 of the best crime labs from throughout the country participated in the program, which compared their analytical findings on different types of evidence, including hair. Their evaluation of hair was dreadful. A majority of the labs were incorrect 4 out of 5 times. Other studies fueled the debate over hair testimony. In one, the accuracy increased when the examiner compared a crime scene hair with those of 5 different men, with no indication as to who was the cop's favored suspect. The chance of unintentional bias was removed. During the same study, though, the accuracy fell dramatically when the examiner was told who was the real suspect. A preconceived conclusion can exist and slant the findings toward that suspect. Hair experts tread on thin legal ice, and their opinions are weighted heavily with caveats, such as, the known hair and the questioned hair are microscopically consistent and could have come from the same source. There is an excellent chance that they could not have come from the same source, but such testimony was rarely volunteered, at least on direct examination. The hundreds of hairs collected at the crime scene by Dennis Smith took a delayed and tortuous route to the courtroom. At least 3 different OSBI analysts handled them, along with dozens of known hairs collected during the Roundup the Usual Suspect sweep made by Detectives Smith and Rogers shortly after the murder. First, Mary Long collected and organized all the hairs at the crime lab, but soon packed them up and handed them to Susan Land. By the time Susan Land received the hairs in March 1983, Dennis Smith and Gary Rogers were convinced the killers were Fritz and Williamson. To the dismay of the investigators, however, her report concluded that the hairs were microscopically consistent only with those of Debbie Carter. For a brief period, Fritz and Williamson were off the hook, though they had no earthly means of knowing it, and years later, their attorneys would not be informed of Susan Land's findings. The state needed a second opinion. In September 1983, citing the stress and strain of Land's workload, her boss ordered her to transfer the case to Melvin Hett. Such a transfer was highly unusual, and made more so by the fact that Land and Het worked in different crime labs in different regions of the state. Land worked in the central crime lab in Oklahoma City. Het worked in a branch in the town of Enid. His region covered 18 counties, none of which happened to be Pontotoc. Het proved to be rather methodical. It took him 27 months to analyze the hair, a lengthy period made even more remarkable by the fact that he was looking only at the samples from Fritz, Williamson, and Debbie Carter. The other 21 were not as important and could wait. Since the police knew who killed Debbie Carter, they helpfully informed Melvin Het. When he received the samples from Susan Land, the word suspect was written by the names of Fritz and Williamson. Glenn Gore had yet to provide samples to the Ada police. On December 13, 1985, 3 years after the murder, Melvin Het finished his first report, finding that 17 of the questioned hairs were microscopically consistent with known samples of Fritz and Williamson. After spending more than 2 years and over 200 hours analyzing the first samples, Het picked up steam considerably and knocked out the other 21 in less than a month. On January 9, 1986, he finished his second report, finding that all the other samples taken from the young men of Ada were consistent with nothing found in the Carter apartment. Still, Glenn Gore had not been asked to provide samples. It was tedious work, and not without its uncertainties. Het flip-flopped several times as he labored with his microscope. Once he was certain a hair belonged to Debbie Carter, but later changed his mind and decided it came from Fritz. Such is the nature of hair analysis. Het flatly contradicted some of Susan Land's findings and even managed to impugn his own work. He initially found that a total of 13 pubic hairs came from Fritz and only 2 from Williamson. Later, though, he changed his numbers, 12 for Fritz and 2 for Williamson. Then 11 for Fritz plus 2 scalp hairs. For some reason, Gore's hair finally entered the picture in July 1986. Someone down at the Ada Police Department woke up and realized Gore had been neglected. Dennis Smith collected scalp and pubic hair from Gore and from the confessed killer Ricky Joe Simmons and mailed them to Melvin Het, who evidently was quite busy because nothing happened for a year. In July 1987, Gore was asked again to provide samples. Why, he asked. Because the police couldn't find his earlier samples. Months passed with no report from Het. In the spring of 1988, the trials were approaching, and there was still no report from Het on the Gore and Simmons samples. On April 7, 1988, after the Fritz trial was underway, Melvin Het finally issued his third and last report. The Gore hairs were not consistent with the questioned hairs. It took Het almost 2 years to reach this conclusion, and his timing was beyond suspicious. It was another clear indication that the prosecution so firmly believed in the guilt of Fritz and Williamson that it found it unnecessary to wait until all the hair analysis was completed. In spite of its perils and uncertainties, Melvin Het was a staunch believer in hair analysis. He and Peterson became friendly, and before the Fritz trial, Het passed along scientific articles touting the reliability of evidence that was famously unreliable. He did not, however, provide the prosecutor with any of the numerous articles condemning hair analysis and testimony. 2 months before the Fritz trial, Het drove to Chicago and delivered his findings to a private lab called McCrone. There, one Richard Bisbing, an acquaintance of Het's, reviewed his work. Bisbing had been hired by Wanda Fritz to review the hair evidence and testify at trial. To pay him, Wanda was forced to sell Dennis's car. Bisbing proved to be far more efficient with his time, but the results were just as conflicting. In less than 6 hours, Bisbing refuted almost all of Het's findings. Looking at only the 11 pubic hairs that Het was certain were microscopically consistent with Fritz, Bisbing found that only 3 were accurate. Only three could have come from Dennis Fritz. Het was wrong about the other eight. Undaunted by such a low estimation of his work by another expert, Het drove back to Oklahoma, ready to testify without changing his opinion. He took the stand on Friday afternoon, April 8th, and immediately launched into a windy lecture loaded with scientific terms and words, designed more to impress the jurors than to inform them. Dennis, with a college degree and experience teaching science, could not follow Het, and he was certain the jurors couldn't either. He glanced at them several times. They were hopelessly lost, but they were obviously impressed with this expert. He knew so much. Het tossed out words like morphology, cortex, scale protrusion, shallow gapping, cortical fuci, and ovoid bodies, as if everyone in the courtroom knew exactly what he meant. He seldom slowed long enough to explain himself. Het was the star expert, with an aura of reliability that was bolstered by his experience, vocabulary, confidence, and strong conclusions that some of the known hairs of Dennis Fritz were consistent with some of those found at the crime scene. Six times during his direct testimony, he said that Dennis's hair and the suspicious hairs were microscopically consistent and could have come from the same source. Not once did he share with the jury the truth that the hairs could have just as easily not come from the same source. Throughout his testimony, Bill Peterson continually referred to the defendant, Ron Williamson, and the defendant, Dennis Fritz. At the time, Ron was locked away in solitary confinement, strumming his guitar, completely unaware that he was being tried in absentia and that things were not going too well. Het wrapped up his testimony by summarizing for the jury his findings. 11 pubic hairs and 2 scalp hairs could have come from Dennis. It was the same 11 pubic hairs he'd driven to the McCrone Laboratories in Chicago and shown to Richard Bisbing for a second opinion. The cross-examination by Greg Saunders yielded little. Het was forced to admit that hair analysis is too speculative to be used for positive identifications. Like most experts, he was able to talk his way out of tough questions by using his endless supply of vague scientific terms. When he was excused, the state rested. The first witness called by the defense was Dennis Fritz. He testified about his past, his friendship with Ron, and so on. He admitted that he had been convicted of cultivating marijuana in 1973 and had lied about this on his application to teach school at Noble 7 years later. His reason for doing so was simple. He needed a job. He denied repeatedly that he had ever met Debbie Carter and certainly knew nothing about her murder. He was then handed over to Bill Peterson for cross-examination. There's an old adage in bad trial lawyering that when you don't have the facts, do a lot of yelling. Peterson stomped to the podium, glared at the murderer with the suspicious hair, and began yelling. Within seconds, Judge Jones called him to the bench for a little chastising. "You may not like this defendant," the judge whispered sternly, "but you're not to be angry in this courtroom." "I'm not angry," Peterson angrily shot back. "Yes, you are. This is the first time you've raised your voice to this bench." "All right." Peterson was incensed that Fritz had lied on a job application. Thus, Dennis simply could not be believed. And Peterson dramatically produced another lie, a form Dennis had filled out when he hawked a pistol at a pawn shop in Durant, Oklahoma. Again, Dennis had tried to hide his felony for cultivating pot. Two clear incidences of outright deception. Neither, of course, had anything to do with the Carter murder. Peterson harangued him for as much mileage as he could possibly beat out of his self-confessed lying. It was ironic, and would have been comical had things not been so tense, that Peterson worked himself into such an indignant lather over a witness who couldn't tell the truth. This from a prosecutor whose case was built on the testimony of convicts and snitches. When Peterson finally decided to move on, he had no place to go. He hopscotched from the allegations of one prosecution witness to another, but Dennis did a credible job of holding his ground. After a contentious one-hour cross, Peterson sat down. The only other witness called by Greg Saunders was Richard Bisbing, who explained to the jury that he disagreed with most of the conclusions reached by Melvin Hett. It was late on Friday afternoon, and Judge Jones adjourned court for the weekend. Dennis made the short walk back to the jail, changed clothes, and tried to relax in his stuffy rat hole of a cell. He was convinced the state had failed to prove him guilty, but he was far from confident. He had seen the nasty looks from the jurors when they were shown the gruesome crime scene photos. He had watched them as they listened to Melvin Hett and believed his conclusions. For Dennis, it was a very long weekend. Closing arguments began Monday morning. Nancy Hsu went first for the state and plodded through a recitation of each of the prosecution's witnesses and what had been said. Greg Saunders countered with an argument that not much at all had been proven by the state, that its burden of proving Dennis guilty beyond a reasonable doubt had clearly not been met, that this was nothing more than a case of guilt by association, and that the jury should find his client not guilty. Bill Peterson had the last shot. For almost an hour, he rambled on and on, regurgitating the high points from each of his witnesses, trying desperately to convince the jurors that his crooks and snitches were worth believing. The jury retired to deliberate at noon, and 6 hours later came back to announce it was split, 11-1. Judge Jones sent them back with the promise of dinner. Around 8 p.m., they returned with a verdict of guilty. Dennis listened to the verdict in a frozen silence, stunned because he was innocent, shocked because he'd been convicted with such paltry proof. He wanted to lash out at the jurors, the judge, the cops, the system. But the trial was not over. Yet he was not totally surprised. He had watched the jurors and seen their distrust. They represented the town of Ada, and the town needed a conviction. If the cops and Peterson were so convinced Dennis was the killer, then he must be. He closed his eyes and thought of his daughter, Elizabeth, now 14, and certainly old enough to understand guilt and innocence. Now that he'd been convicted, how would he ever convince her he was innocent? As the crowd filed out of the courthouse, Peggy Stillwell fainted on the courthouse lawn. She was exhausted and overcome by emotion and grief. She was rushed to the nearest hospital, but was soon released. With the issue of guilt now settled, the trial moved quickly into the penalty phase. In theory, the jury would determine the sentence based on aggravating circumstances presented by the state and designed to get the death penalty, and mitigating circumstances presented by the defendant that would, hopefully, save his life. The Fritz penalty phase was very brief. Peterson called to the stand Rusty Featherstone, who finally got to tell the jury that Dennis had admitted to him that he and Ron had been bar-hopping in Norman some 4 months before the murder. That was the extent of his testimony. The two murder suspects had actually driven 70 miles to Norman and spent a long night in the clubs and lounges. The next and last witness expanded on this profound story. Her name was Levita Brewer, and while having a drink in the bar at a Holiday Inn in Norman, she bumped into Fritz and Williamson. After several drinks, the three left together. Brewer got in the back seat. Dennis was behind the wheel. Ron was next to him, and away they went. It was raining. Dennis was driving fast, running red lights and such, and at some point early in the adventure, Brewer became hysterical. Though the two never touched or threatened her, she decided that she really wanted to get out. But Dennis wouldn't stop. This went on for 15 or 20 minutes. Then the car slowed enough for her to open the door and jump. She ran to a payphone and called the police. No one was injured. No charges were filed. No one was ever convicted. But to Bill Peterson, the incident was clear proof that Dennis Fritz was an ongoing threat to society and should be put to death to protect other young ladies. Levita Brewer was the best and only witness he could produce. During his impassioned plea for death to the jury, Peterson looked at Dennis, pointed his finger, and said, "Dennis Fritz, you deserve to die for what you and Ron Williamson did to Deborah Sue Carter." To which Dennis interrupted and said to the jury, "I did not kill Debbie Carter." 2 hours later, the jury returned with a sentence of life in prison. When the verdict was read, Dennis stood, faced the jury, and said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I would just like to say..." "Excuse me," said Judge Jones.
"Dennis, you can't do that," Greg Saunders said.
But Dennis was not to be denied. He continued, "My Lord Jesus in heaven knows I didn't do this. I just want you to know that I forgive you. I'll be praying for you." Back in his cell, in the muggy darkness of his little corner of hell, he found no relief whatsoever in the fact that he had avoided a death sentence. He was 38 years old, an innocent man without a violent tendency in his being, and the prospect of spending the rest of his life in prison was utterly overwhelming. Chapter 9. Annette Hudson had closely followed the Fritz trial by reading the daily reports in the Ada Evening News. On Tuesday, April 12th, the front page headline read, "Fritz Found Guilty in Carter Murder." As usual, the story mentioned her brother. Ron Williamson, who is also charged with first-degree murder in Carter's murder, is scheduled to be tried here on April 21st. In fact, all six articles covering the Fritz trial mentioned Ron's involvement and upcoming trial. "How do they expect to find an impartial jury?" Annette asked herself repeatedly. "If one co-defendant is found guilty, how could the other one get a fair trial in the same town?" She bought Ron a new gray suit, an extra pair of navy slacks, two white shirts, two ties, and new shoes. On April 20th, the day before his trial began, Ron was taken to court for a chat with Judge Jones. The judge was worried that the defendant might be disruptive, a valid concern given his history. As Ron stood before the bench, the judge said, "I want to see where we stand on your attendance tomorrow, and make sure that when you're here, that there won't be any disturbances. Do you understand my concern?" Ron: "As long as they don't start telling me that I've killed somebody." Judge Jones: "Well, you understand that they're going to do that." Ron: "Well, I understand that, but it's not right." Judge Jones knew that Ron had been a great athlete, so he used the analogy of a sports contest. "It's kind of like a sporting event as far as the adversary process. Each side has an opportunity to be on offense, and they have the opportunity to be on defense, but you can't take issue with the fact that each side gets these opportunities. That's just part of the process." Ron: "Yeah, but I'm the football being kicked." For the prosecution, the Fritz trial was a nice warm-up for the main event. Virtually the same witnesses would be used, and in much the same order. But in the next trial, the state had two additional advantages. First, the defendant was mentally incompetent and prone to knock over tables and blurt out obscenities, behavior that most people, including jurors, frowned on. He could be eerily frightening. He scared people. Second, his lawyer was blind and alone. Since the court-appointed co-counsel, Baber, had withdrawn from the case April 1st, there had been no replacement. Barney was quick on his feet and a great cross-examiner, but not effective arguing over fingerprints, photographs, and hair analysis. For the defense, the trial couldn't start soon enough. Barney was sick of Ron Williamson and frustrated with the sheer number of hours the case was draining away from his other paying clients. And he was afraid of Ron, physically afraid. He arranged to have his son, not a lawyer, sit closely behind Ron at the defense table. Barney planned to sit as far away as possible, which wasn't far at all, and if Ron made a sudden aggressive move on Barney, then his son was to jump Ron from the rear and take him down. Such was the level of trust between lawyer and client. But few people in the packed courtroom on April 21st realized that the son was protecting the father from the client. Most of those present were potential jurors, strangers to such settings, and uncertain as to who was who. There were also reporters, curious lawyers, and the usual assortment of gossips that trials in small towns attract, especially murder trials. Annette Hudson and Renee Simmons sat in the front row as close to Ronnie as possible. Several of Annette's close friends had volunteered to sit with her throughout the trial and offer support. She declined. Her brother was sick and unpredictable, and she didn't want her friends to see him in cuffs and shackles. Nor did she want them subjected to explicit and gruesome testimony. She and Renee had suffered through the preliminary hearing and gotten a strong taste of what was coming at trial. There were no friends there for Ron. Across the aisle, the Carter family held down the front row, the same place they'd been during the Fritz trial. The opposing sides tried not to make eye contact. It was a Thursday, almost a full year after the exhumation of the victim's body and the arrests of Ron and Dennis. Ron's last significant treatment had been at Central State some 13 months earlier. At Barney's request, he'd been seen once by Norma Walker in Ada, a brief visit that began and ended like most of his visits to the local clinic. For a year, his medications, when he received any at all, had been erratically dispensed by the jailers. The time spent in his solitary hole in the jail had done nothing to improve his mental health. Yet his mental health concerned no one but his family. Neither the prosecution, the defense, nor the court itself had raised the issue. It was time for a trial. The excitement of opening day quickly wore off as the tedium of jury selection hit hard. Hours passed as the lawyers questioned the pool and Judge Jones methodically dismissed one after the other. Ron, for his part, behaved himself. He looked nice, a haircut, a shave, new clothes. He took pages of notes, all under the eyes of Barney's son, who, though as bored as the others, managed to keep an eye on the client. Ron had no idea why he was being watched so closely. Late in the afternoon, the final 12 were chosen. 7 men, 5 women, all white. Judge Jones gave them their instructions and sent them home. They would not be sequestered. Annette and Renee were hopeful. One juror was the son-in-law of a neighbor who lived across the street from Annette. Another was related to a Pentecostal preacher who surely knew of Juanita Williamson and her devotion to her church. Another was a distant cousin of a Williamson relative by marriage. Most of the jurors looked familiar. Annette and Renee had seen them at one time or another around Ada. It was indeed a small town. The jurors were back by 9 the following morning. Nancy Hsu gave the opening statement for the state, almost a carbon copy of the one she had used for Fritz. Barney deferred his initial remarks until after the state's case-in-chief was finished. The first witness called by the prosecution was again Glenn Gore, but things did not go as planned. After stating his name, Gore went silent and refused to testify. He invited Judge Jones to hold him in contempt. What did it matter? He was serving 40 years anyway. His reasons were not clear, but perhaps had something to do with the fact that he was doing time at the state prison where snitches were held in low regard by their peers, as opposed to the Pontotoc County Jail, where snitching was rampant. After a few moments of confusion, it was decided by Judge Jones that Gore's testimony from the preliminary hearing the previous July would be read to the jury. This was done, and though the impact was somewhat lessened, the jury still heard Gore's fictitious account of seeing Ron at the coach light the night of the murder. Barney was robbed of the opportunity to grill Gore on his numerous felonies and their violent nature. Nor did the defense get the chance to question the witness on his whereabouts and movements on the night of the murder. With Gore out of the way, the state's case quickly got back on track. Tommy Glover, Gina Vieta, and Charlie Carter gave the same testimony for the third time. Gary Allen told the same strange story of hearing two men squirt themselves with a water hose at 3:30 a.m. early in December 1982, but emphatically could not identify Ron Williamson. The other man might have been Fritz, but maybe not. The truth was that Gary Allen couldn't identify anyone, and had no idea when the incident occurred. He was a drug addict, well known to the police. He knew Dennis Smith because they had attended classes at the local college. Smith approached him shortly after the murder and asked if he'd seen or heard anything suspicious in the early hours of December 8th. Allen said he had seen two men squirting themselves with a water hose at the house next door, but could not remember the date. Dennis Smith and Gary Rogers jumped to the conclusion that it was Fritz and Williamson washing off the blood of Debbie Carter. They pressed Allen for details, even showed him a photo of the murder scene. They suggested that the two men were Fritz and Williamson, but Allen could not and would not identify the two. Shortly before the trial, Gary Rogers stopped by Allen's apartment and again suggested details. Wasn't it really Fritz and Williamson, and didn't he see them outside early in the morning sometime around December 8th? No, Allen could not be certain. Rogers brushed his coat away from his hip so Allen could see his service revolver. He said that Allen might get lead poisoning if his memory didn't improve. It did, but just barely enough to testify. Dennis Smith then walked the jury through the crime scene, the photographing, fingerprinting, evidence gathering. Photos were passed to the jurors with the same predictable reactions when they saw the victim. Using a fire truck ladder, the police photographer had shot some aerials of Debbie's apartment. Peterson used one of them and asked Smith to tell the jury where the Williamson house was located. Only a few blocks away. Barney said, "Let me see those photos," and they were handed over. As was the unwritten rule in Ada, Barney took the photos and stepped outside with his assistant, Linda. She described each one to him in detail. The direct examination was matter of fact, but Barney had some fireworks on Cross. He'd always thought it was odd that the two alleged killers could pull off such a heinous rape and murder without leaving a single fingerprint. He asked Smith to explain the best surfaces for an investigator to dust for prints. Smooth, hard surfaces, glass, mirrors, hard plastic, painted wood, and so on. Then he walked Smith through the small apartment and forced him to admit that he had neglected many obvious locations. Kitchen appliances, the glass in the bedroom window that was left open, bathroom fixtures, door facings, mirrors. The list grew and grew, and the impression was clear that Smith had done a poor job of checking for prints. With the witness on his heels, Barney hammered away. When he became too aggressive, either Bill Peterson or Nancy Shue would object to his tactics, and their objections usually brought an acerbic retort from Barney. Gary Rogers took the stand next and continued a detailed summary of the investigation. But his most important contribution to the state's case was recounting for the jury the dream confession Ron made the day after he was arrested. It sounded just fine on direct exam, but Barney had a few problems with it. He was quite curious as to why the statement was not recorded. Rogers admitted that the police owned and often used a video camera, and when pressed by Barney, he admitted that sometimes it wasn't used when the investigators weren't sure what the witness might say. Why run the risk of recording something harmful to the prosecution but helpful to the defendant? Rogers admitted that the police department owned a tape recorder and that he knew how to operate it. It wasn't used in the interview with Ron because that would not have been within their normal procedures. Barney didn't buy that either. Rogers also admitted that the police department had a ready supply of pencils and paper, but stumbled badly when he tried to explain why he and Rusty Featherstone did not allow Ron to write his own statement. They refused to let him see it, either, after they were through with it, and Barney piled on the suspicion. As he drilled Rogers about his unusual procedures, Rogers made a huge mistake. He mentioned Ron's 1983 interrogation on video, in which Ron had steadfastly denied any involvement. Barney was incredulous. Why had he not been told of this tape? Pretrial discovery required the prosecution to hand over all exculpatory evidence. Barney had timely filed the proper motions months earlier. The prior September, the court had ordered the prosecution to provide defense counsel with all statements made by Ron relative to the murder investigation. How could the police and prosecutor sit on the tape for 4.5 years and hide it from the defense? Barney had very few witnesses at his disposal, since the case against Ron was basically an admission case, one in which the state was using a variety of witnesses, albeit a rather sketchy collection, to testify that Ron, at various times and in various ways, admitted to the murder. The only real way to fight such testimony was to deny it, and the only person who could deny making the admissions was Ron himself. Barney planned to put Ron on the stand in his own defense, but he was terrified of the prospect. The 1983 tape would have been a powerful tool to show the jury. 4.5 years earlier, long before the prosecution had put together its roster of shady witnesses, and long before Ron had such a lengthy criminal record to answer to, he had sat before a camera and repeatedly denied any involvement. In a famous 1963 decision, Brady v. Maryland, the U.S. Supreme Court held that the suppression by the prosecution of evidence favorable to an accused upon request violates due process where the evidence is material either to guilt or to punishment, irrespective of the good faith or bad faith of the prosecution. Investigators have all the resources. Frequently, they uncover witnesses or other evidence favorable to a suspect or defendant. For decades, they could simply ignore this exculpatory evidence and proceed with a prosecution. Brady leveled the field and instantly became ingrained in criminal procedure. A Brady request is one of many routine motions a criminal defense lawyer files early in the case. A Brady motion, a Brady hearing, Brady material. I nailed him on Brady. The case worked its way into the vernacular of criminal law practice. Now Barney stood before Judge Jones, with Rogers still in the witness chair and Peterson studying his shoes, with a clear Brady violation. He moved for a mistrial and was overruled. Judge Jones promised to hold a hearing on the matter after the trial was over. It was late on Friday, and everyone was tired. Judge Jones recessed until 8:30 Monday morning. Ron was handcuffed, surrounded by deputies, and hustled out of the courtroom. He had behaved himself so far, and it had not gone unnoticed. The front page of Sunday's Ada Evening News ran the headline, "Williamson Controlled During Trial's First Day." The first witness Monday was Dr. Fred Jordan, who, for the third time in the same seat, testified in detail about the autopsy and cause of death. It was also the third time that Peggy Stillwell had suffered through it, and the ordeal was certainly not getting any easier. Fortunately, she could not see the photos they were passing around to the jurors. She could see their reactions, and that was enough. Dr. Jordan was followed by Tony Vick, Fritz's neighbor, Donna Walker, the convenience store clerk, and Letha Caldwell, the late-night acquaintance, all three as useless as they'd been in the Fritz trial. The fireworks started when Terry Holland was called next. During the preliminary hearing, she'd been able to spin her yarns with no fear of getting caught. Now, though, with Ron glaring at her and knowing the truth, things would be different. The tales started immediately. Holland was describing statements Ron allegedly made in jail about Debbie Carter, and it was obvious Ron was about to explode. He shook his head, clenched his jaws, stared at Holland as if he'd like to kill her. Finally, she said, he said if she'd went ahead and went with him, he'd never had to kill her. Ron said, "Oh!" loudly. Nancy Shue asked, "Did you ever hear a phone conversation that he made that related to Debbie Carter in any way?" Holland, "I was working in the laundry. I was a trustee. Ron was on the phone to his mom, and he told his mother he was trying to get her to bring him cigarettes or something. I'm not sure what, but he was hollering at her, and he told her that if she didn't, that he'd have to kill her like he did Debbie Carter." To which Ron yelled, "She is lying!" Nancy Shue continued, "Ms. Holland, did you ever hear him describe or talk about any of the details of Debbie Carter's death?" Holland, "He was telling, I guess in the bullpen, the guys back there, that he,
He said he shoved a Coke bottle up her ass and her panties down her throat. Ron jumped up, pointed at her, and yelled, "You are lying! I never said nothing like that in my life. I did not kill this girl, and I call you a liar!"
Barney, "Be still, Ron."
Ron, "I don't know what you're... I mean, you're gonna pay for that!"
There was a pause as everyone caught their breath, and Barney slowly rose to his feet. He knew exactly what was coming. Repair work. The prosecution's star witness had botched a couple of crucial facts, the panties and the Coke bottle, a common problem with fabricated testimony. With the courtroom tense, a lying witness exposed, and Barney already waiting to pounce, Nancy Hsu tried to fix the damage.
"Hsu, Miss Holland, let me ask you about the details you were just relating. As far as your memory goes, are you sure about the objects that he stated he used? You said Coke bottle."
Barney, "If the court please, if the court please, I heard what she said, and I don't want this district attorney changing her testimony any either. And I object to that."
Holland, "He said, Coke bottle or ketchup bottle or bottle?"
Barney, "See what I mean? If the court please."
Holland, "It's been 4 years.
Ron, "Yeah, and you're a..."
Barney, "Hush."
Hsu, "Miss Holland, can you... I know you overheard different things."
Barney, "If the court please."
Hsu, "Can you think of..."
Barney, "I'm going to object to this leading and suggestive questioning that the district attorney is doing."
The court,
"State a question without posturing anything in front of it."
Hsu, "Did he ever tell why? You said that he killed..."
Holland, "He wanted to sleep with Debbie Carter."
Ron, "You're a liar!"
Barney,
"Shut up!"
Ron, standing,
"She's a liar. I ain't gonna sit for it. I didn't kill Debbie Carter, and you are lying."
Barney, "Ronnie, come on, sit down."
Peterson, "Judge, can we have a recess, please?"
Barney, "I object to counsel's sidebar comments, Your Honor."
Barney, "These aren't sidebar comments, if the court please."
The court, "Wait a minute."
Barney, "I'm talking to this defendant."
The court, "Wait a minute.
Ask your next question. Mr. Williamson, I must admonish you that you are not allowed to speak from the chair you are now in."
Hsu, "Miss Holland, can you recall if he ever said why he did what he did?"
Holland, "Because she wouldn't sleep with him."
Ron, "You're lying! Damn it! Tell the truth! I never killed nobody in my life!"
Barney, "Judge, I'd like to ask if we could have a recess for a few minutes here."
The court, "All right. Remember your instructions. The jury may step down."
Ron, "Could I speak to her, please?
Let me talk to her. What is she talking about?"
A short break cooled things down. With the jury absent, Judge Jones had a nice chat with Ron, who assured His Honor that he could behave himself. When the jury returned, the judge explained that the case was to be decided on the evidence only and nothing else. Not comments from the attorneys, and certainly not comments and actions by the defendant. But Ron's chilling threat of, "You're going to pay for that," was clearly heard by the jurors. They, too, were afraid of him. During the melee, Nancy Hsu was unable to completely resuscitate her witness. With leading and suggestive questions, she was able to transform the Coke bottle to a ketchup bottle, but the little detail of the panties in the mouth went uncorrected. The bloody washcloth was never mentioned by Terry Holland. The next hot check artist called by the state to help find the truth was Cindy McIntosh, but the poor girl was so confused she couldn't remember which story she was expected to tell. She drew a blank and was finally dismissed without completing her duties. Mike Tenney and John Christian told of their late-night chats with Ron in his cell and some of the strange things he said. Neither bothered to mention that Ron repeatedly denied any involvement in the murder and would often scream for hours that he was innocent. After a quick lunch, Peterson lined up the OSBI agents in the same order as in the Fritz trial. Jerry Peters went first and told his story of reprinting Debbie's hands after the exhumation because he was uncertain about a tiny portion of her left palm. Barney tried to pin him down on exactly how and why this became an issue 4.5 years after the autopsy, but Peters proved elusive. Did he worry about his initial findings for such a long period of time? Or did Bill Peterson call at random one day early in 1987